I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And they were going, "How much?" to me, and he went, "Eh, cheeky bastard, eh," because I've got a tracksuit on.
Hello and welcome. This is episode 14 of the Paul Ryder Tapes, where Happy Monday's founding member and bass player Paul Ryder sat down with me, his ex-wife Angela Smith, to tell his unfiltered life story. And then 12 days after we finished recording, he passed away suddenly. Coming up in this episode.
It was kind of, yeah, it's bad, isn't it? And it's like, Paul, mate, that jail's burning down. It's more than bad. That probably is like just another night in the world of the Happy Mondays.
I got back to the hotel and puked up. The emotions was, I don't know exactly what I was feeling, but it made me physically sick.
Michael Winterbottom was so blown away by his acting. He just said that he really plays sinister well to play these gangsters, really, who ran the door.
Don't put that in. Don't put that in. Look at me.
We left off the last episode as the house we'd bought in France was on fire.
Yeah, and I had a fire going, a real fire in the fireplace.
Yeah.
Which was, it was roaring. It was a nice fire because it was a winter's night.
Yeah.
October, yeah. So it was lovely and warm and I looked up and saw, like, the roof was on fire, the ceiling. That's when I called you, saying, "It's on fire, what do I do?"
You were outside, though, smoking, weren't you? Didn't you go outside for a cigarette, and that's when you saw the roof on fire?
That's when I saw the roof on fire, yeah, yeah.
And I said, "I don't know the number for the fire brigade, but go and ask Norbert, go and ask Monsieur Lanel, who lived next door."
Yeah.
So we had quite a long driveway, so I could hear you on the other end of the phone walking down the driveway.
Yeah, yeah.
And I heard you knocking on the door, and you said, he's not in. I said, "Well, go across the street to Norbert."
That's right,
so
yeah.
I heard you walk across the street, rat-a-tat-tat on Norbert's door, and I heard you go, "Norbert, Norbert, fire, fire," and I heard you go, commotion. And then you came back on the phone to me and you said...
No, you said, "Where's Sonny
no,
and Chico?"
No, 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 you didn't.
Oh,
you said
on.
To me, "What shall I do about the children?" You'd left the two boys in the house that was burning.
Yes. I didn't think it was dangerous at the time because it was on the roof. I didn't think about things falling down. I got them out safely.
"Get them out! Yeah. Get them out!" And then the phone cut off.
Oh.
So I was driving through the forest in a dead zone, not knowing whether my kids were perishing in a fire for about 5 minutes until I could get hold of you on the phone again. And you said, "It's okay, they're out, it's fine."
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I didn't really care whether the house burned down or not, as long as everybody was okay. Our friend, former MTV producer Alan Howard, was staying with us at the time, and I was out with him when I got the call saying that the place was on fire.
There was that moment as we were driving down the country lane and we turn a corner and there's beautiful rolling pine forests either side, and in the middle there's this plume of smoke coming up that was your house. And so we go flying down there and pull into the village, and which is a pretty small village, pretty small little French village, and there's three or four big French fire engines there, pumping God knows how many litres of water into the building. And when we got there, the fireman said to me, my car was parked right next to the chateau, and he was basically saying, voiture, voiture, allez, allez. And I kind of knew enough French to know that meant get your bloody car moved. So I jumped into my lovely little Golf convertible I had at the time and drove it as quick as I could straight onto the lawn. And just as I did that, there was this big lump of the roof came flying down and just crashed right where my car was, like 10 seconds previously, which was kind of scary. I kind of, you get like, Jesus, that was a close call. I think the next hour or so, we probably just watched the chateau burning down.
And it really did burn down the whole east
half
wing.
Of it, yeah. The whole village came out to watch it. They all had sandwiches and drinks, didn't they?
Yeah, they all
it
came
was like
out. To...
There was a show on in the village.
we were just stood there like idiots watching the house burn.
Alan was struck by Paul's demeanour.
Paul was inordinately calm, as I remember, and it was almost like it was happening in slow motion. He was kind of, yeah, it's bad, isn't it? And it's like, Paul, mate, that's your house burning down. It's more than bad. But he was like he always was. He was like very kind of subdued, is possibly the word. I would have expected him to be a little bit more concerned about what was going on. But he just kind of took everything in his stride.
You filmed on the night, because I remember saying to you, Alan, get your camera, and you filmed a bit with me, and I said, this is all I've got left in the world, a cup.
My house is just burning down.
And there was a little bit of footage of the flames burning, but very, very little. I don't think you felt comfortable filming too much that night.
It wasn't a case of I felt comfortable. It was a case of, like, I didn't really know. I mean, if I'd kind of been... Don't know. There was a massive... When your house was burning down, and I kind of felt like filming it wasn't the best thing I could do for you guys, I think.
Yeah. And that's when Rosemary and
John and their four kids...
That's when they turned up.
Yeah. Our friends Rosemary and John Barrett and their four kids were on their way to visit us for a week for a holiday, and Rosemary, who's a journalist, was going to write a travel feature about this wonderful property that you would love to go and visit for your holidays.
We arrived and we thought we were coming to a nice warm chateau and a takeaway meal, but we came to find it like, you know, it was like flames. Yeah, very warm chateau, exactly. With flames shooting out of the roof.
It's like, I think we might have to stay somewhere else for the next few days.
Yeah, that was devastating, really.
Yeah,
what happened to it? No, we just finished it.
But the firemen did rescue a lot of the stuff.
Oh,
they moved
the
piano and all kinds of furniture from one side to the other.
Yeah, they did a great job.
And we stayed there till about midnight watching it burn down while the fire brigade was trying to put the flames out.
Yeah.
And somebody in the village had a big place, and like a dormitory type thing where school kids went, so they let us stay there.
Let us stay there.
So we were very fortunate about the French tradition that the village have to accommodate anybody whose house burns down. So we ended up spending the night in this wonderful hostel that was absolutely freezing. There was no heating. I think we slept in our clothes with all our coats on the bed. And I think we ended up boiling a kettle and making pot noodles with what was it like? Did we end up putting sausages in the kettle or something, didn't we?
And then the next morning we got up and I walked back with you to the house expecting a pile of ash.
Mm-hmm.
And actually I was really surprised and happy that half of the house was untouched.
Completely untouched.
And the other half wasn't too bad, apart from a lot of water damage from the from the firemen's water. But the roof was burned off.
The roof
and
was
the,
off.
And the our beloved, we called it the porno suite, the room with the...
Jason King suite.
It wasn't the Jason King suite, it was the one with the gold bath.
Oh, right.
That's obviously where the fire had started, and that was absolutely black and ashen and completely and utterly destroyed.
The bath was gone.
The bath was gone. I mean, it was just literally ash, wasn't it?
I went back the next morning, and it was just extraordinary. There was the whole place was, well, the whole top of the house was, we walked in and there was just like water from the fire engines pouring through the ceiling still. The walls were just, the supporting walls were just charcoal. You could literally pull off lumps of charcoal and write your name on the wall. We went up to the bedroom, which we probably shouldn't have gone up those stairs considering. But we went up into the bedroom where there was no roof anymore. Where my kids and ex had been the night before, and on the beds they were sleeping on, there was just the metal frames of the beds left because it had all been burnt away, and the James Bond golden bath had melted.
It completely melted. The whole bath was burnt to a cinder. The bath.
There's footage somewhere of us walking round the house, and Paul, and basically I'm saying to Paul, "So Paul, how you feeling? Tell me." And it's like, "Oh yeah, wasn't it was a bit funny old night." It's like, "Paul, mate, I remember he had a little hat on, and he was walking around, and it was, I don't know, it was like just another night, really." And I if that probably is like just another night in the world of the Happy Mondays, it probably was like that.
And this was Paul the morning after the fire, perusing the damage.
I had a lovely fire going just in there, burning nicely, ready for the guests to arrive. And then the smoke alarms went off. And I looked up and saw flames coming out the roof.
I asked our cameraman from the Manchester office, Phil Smethurst, to come over to France for a few days and help film some of the aftermath of the fire. Paul went to the airport to pick him up. He's also a cameraman and editor on this show.
I remember being nervous going to meet him because I knew of the Mondays, do you know, clearly, do you know, I was a big indie kid at the time. So I was quite nervous about meeting him because I'd not really met many celebs at the time. Like, and then we got in the car and he was just the soundest bloke. I think we just chatted nonsense pretty much for 2 hours. But yeah, he was, it's kind of... I don't think I was necessarily shocked, but it gave me a certain introduction to two celebs and going, "No, right, do you know what? They're just normal people, aren't they, really?" It was like a castle. It's a castle in a village. And then I think we saw it from the front, which didn't look damaged. And then when we sort of pulled up and came round the front, I was like, it's both amazing and it's completely and utterly gutted on one side of the house. I remember taking GVs of having water dripping from the chandeliers and stuff. And then I was straight in with the camera and it was like, it's an insane place. And then it's also just had an insane amount of damage. It's just like, it was shocking in both ways, really. It was like shocked at the size of the place and then shocked at the damage that was caused from the fire. But he wasn't fazed. He just seemed to take it in his stride that his big house in France had half gone. And yet, it was like just another day in the life of Paul Ryder, I suppose. And we went on a tour of everything. What sticks in my head, and only because we've revisited the footage quite a lot, was the fox.
Yes, we had a stuffed fox, and sadly, it perished in the fire.
Hey, his tail's burnt off. Where's the fire?
And so we decided that we would have to stay in France to sort this all out, and so we put the boys in school, in the local village school.
Oh, yes, I remember that. They hated it.
Yeah.
They hated it.
Phil remembers us inflicting some trauma on our children by making them go to school.
And then the kids going to school, we filmed a lot with the kids going in. I don't know if... had they been in a bit, or had they not? I know they were heartbroken about having to go, and I know that you and Paul were both heartbroken at having to sort of lead them there.
I mean, I can't believe, like, why I was so adamant that they were only tiny. Like, why was I making them go to school? Like, with hindsight now, I think they didn't need to go to school at that age, like, for a couple of months. They could have had a couple of months off.
And this was us dropping them off. Oh, they were so upset.
It's a classroom. It's a classroom. Come on, Fanny's waiting. That's what Fanny's waiting.
Come on. You try to do what's best, don't you? You try to do what's right. But there's a fine line between making them do something that really traumatises them.
And our sons, Sonny and Chico, back then, had a very strong memory of what their dad said when he saw the fire.
Daddy said a naughty word when the fire was going.
What?
On the roof.
Oh, shit.
We then had a lot of fun and games with insurance assessors. Remember the two insurance companies that were vying for our business?
Yeah.
There were two insurance assessors fighting for our business that almost came to blows because they both wanted to represent us because they get a cut of it.
Yeah.
And then we finally agreed on one. But the first job that had to be done was waterproofing the roof. So tell us about those roofers that came to...
So we was kind of forced to live in France. We'd spoke about moving there quite a few times.
Yeah.
And... forced by fire to live there while we sorted half of the house that was burnt down. So we got a roof around who put up this tarpaulin and like tried to make it waterproof, but it rained and it was just such a bad job.
Yeah.
It ruined everything that was left inside the house because it was letting water in.
Cameraman Phil Smethurst remembers Paul desperately trying to salvage his possessions.
Do you remember him looking for his lyrics book?
I do, yeah. He had a bag, it was like a brown leather bag that he was like, and I don't know, it just meant a lot to him. I think it was just quite a small book, wasn't it? Just a little scrapbook full of lyrics that you would have imagined would be ruined given the amount of water. And I think he found it in the kitchen, the lower kitchen, underneath where the turret had completely, like, been destroyed. And then found this bag, and somehow in this leather or faux leather bag, he found this book that had had barely any damage to it. It looked like a minor spill at best.
No way. Survived. Soaking wet, but it's there.
So the whole house was completely ruined on that one half, and everything had to be gutted and rebuilt.
Completely rebuilt.
Yeah.
Done.
Okay. So we're back.
Hi.
Hello. It was a bit heavy yesterday's session, wasn't it?
Very heavy. I got back to the hotel and puked up.
Really?
The emotions was... I don't know exactly what I was feeling, but it made me physically sick.
Why do you think that was?
It was like a therapy session. Yeah. Heavy therapy session yesterday.
Yeah.
Just brought up a load of old stuff.
Yeah.
Very heavy.
I wanted to say, I feel like I'm focusing on all the bad stuff.
Ooh.
And I feel like I need to say to you that it's really brave that you're doing this.
Oh, thank you.
And I just want to acknowledge that it's really brave what you're doing.
I don't normally do interviews.
I know.
Especially in depth like this from my ex-wife.
Who knows all the secrets? No, but I mean, I'm hoping that it'll help some people, especially people who are struggling with addiction, and especially also partners of people that are struggling with addiction.
Yeah.
To hear the other stories, to know that they're not alone and that the struggle is real.
I hope it helps somebody, yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah. I mean, you've already been approached by somebody who told you that you are responsible for them taking heroin.
Yeah.
But I hope you're also responsible for people approaching you and saying you inspired them to get into recovery.
Oh, that would be good.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Because, like, why are we given these trials and tribulations in our lives? There's got to be a reason, hasn't there?
There has to be a reason to get where I am today, for you to get where you are today.
Yeah.
I think we're both living good lives right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We are.
I think we have to go through that shit.
But, like, from a today perspective, for me, I've kind of processed it all and it's fine. And then when you go into it and you start talking about it, you realise it really wasn't fine at the time.
I was quite sick.
It was really, really traumatic.
Yeah.
And I think that it's easy to underestimate the toll that it takes on you.
Very much so.
And also, the other thing that I want to come across is that, and you can tell, you can say this with more authority than me, but addiction isn't a choice. Addiction is a disease.
Definitely.
And I'm not trying to excuse any of the behaviour, but addiction isn't simply, oh, I just want to get off my head because I want to have a party. It's about medicating a pain.
Yeah.
And I think, I might have said this before, but I think that the problem with getting clean, and I've witnessed this with you, is that if you don't address the reasons that you picked up in the first place, you still have that pain.
Mm.
And what do you do with that pain? If you don't process that and get rid of it in some sense, then you just look for, if you put the drugs down, you look for another way to medicate that pain.
Yeah, you swap addictions, or for me it was getting therapy afterwards, after doing the detox, going to therapy for so many years that helped me stay clean.
But it's not a quick fix, is it?
No.
You can't just do a month and then come out and then you fix because you've had a few group therapy sessions.
No, but I carried on with therapy after that initial 3 months in Venice in California.
Yeah.
You know.
But, I salute you.
Thank you very much.
No, seriously, it's like...
I salute you for putting up with me.
Well, there's a question mark over whether that was the right thing to do for me at the time.
That's true.
But you just deal with it day to day, don't you? You do what is right for you at the time.
That's why they say just one day at a time.
Yeah.
That's all you can do.
But you do have a choice.
Yeah.
As a partner of somebody who's an addict, you do have a choice. You can't control what they do, but you can control what you do.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it feels impossible to step away from somebody that you love.
Yeah.
Especially when you recognise that it's a disease and it isn't really just a choice, which, you know, people who are not affected by addiction...
Yeah, I think it's more recognised over here in America as a disease than it is in England.
Yeah.
It's definitely recognised more as a disease.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What can be done, though? Like, what is the solution?
Wow. For using addicts?
Yeah.
Well, I've always said... Because I did it through NA and AA. I've always said they're not the only way. It all depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's other ways of doing the sobriety thing.
Mm-hmm.
You just got to find out what's right for you.
Mm. But what's the first step?
The detox.
Yeah.
Get a good detox.
So is it just lack of resources, do you think? Like if detoxes were easier to come by and not as expensive?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Detox and aftercare.
Detox, and aftercare, support groups, personal therapy. You got to follow it up with something.
Mm.
It's like you said, you just left empty, with still with the disease.
Yeah.
Festering.
Yeah.
Doing its push-up, just waiting for you to relapse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So thank you for sharing your story and laying it all out.
That's cool.
Okay, so we were talking about 24-hour party people.
Yeah.
And I thought of something really funny that happened.
You're going to tell the story going to Cannes, to the film festival. Go on.
So,
and I couldn't even get in my own party. afterwards.
Oh, really?
After the premiere. That? We couldn't get in.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Oh, it took us like half an hour to get through the fucking...
Oh, and you were in the band as well. It was a... Okay, let's go back to the beginning. So the movie was being screened at the Cannes Film Festival. It was a big event.
Big event.
And the key actors from the film were invited, including you.
Mm-hmm.
And I came with you.
Yeah.
And for some reason, there was a mix-up with the tickets, and we ended up being sat with the public rather than sat with the film people.
Yeah.
And and when it was, when the screening was over, we were herded out with all of the regular people and not down the mm-hmm. important people's exit. And we were herded out, and this photographer stopped us and wanted to take pictures of us.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, he's recognised you. He knows who you are. And so we posed for these pictures feeling like we were really important. Mm-hmm. And then he handed us his card and said, oh, it'd be $300 or €300 each for the pictures. And he was just one of these fly-by-night photographers trying to make a few euros on the
another
side.
Another Spinal Tap moment
in my
life.
It was funny. The Rock and Roll Mums, Paul and Sean's mum Linda and Gaz Whelan's mum Sandra, went to see the film when it was released.
When 24 Hour Party People came out, and we went to the print works to see it, there was all these younger people, and there's me and Derek. When the lights came up at the end and we stood up, these two oldies.
It was funny. It was like we went from being, oh, we're really important, to like, oh, actually, no, we're not.
And all these young people was looking at us as if we'd got three heads.
So the cast of the band who played the roles of the Mundys in the film were playing a gig in Cannes at the party for its premiere, and Paul Ryder was going to join them for a few songs. I wanted to get the take of Paul Popplewell, who played the role of Paul Ryder in the film and became good friends with Paul as a result. But a family of crickets had invaded our studio and I wanted them to be quiet.
Oh, this is ridiculous.
Where are they?
They're like in the top of the boxes, I think.
Oh, right. They make a nest.
Yeah, I think so.
I thought it was crap.
Somebody paid for the lads who played the Happy Mondays to have 2 weeks, maybe a week or two, in a studio in Manchester to rehearse, to do five or six songs at the premiere.
Rowetta was in the film too, playing herself.
Paul played his own bass. With the baggy undies, we called them, or what, crappy undies, whatever we called them. So we did, I think we did the rap party at the Astoria. We did one at the Astoria. We did a diesel party at Fabric. And we did Cannes Film Festival, which is incredible, really, to play when it was up for a Palme d'Or. I think that was, and there was a lot of pride there. Tony Wilson was with us as well.
I wish I could be more like you, really, because I go in, woof, and then I think, why did you do that? Why did you do it?
You said to me, I say what I think. And I said to you, I think what before I say it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Linda does think, I don't think. And I go, bruh. And then I think, I shouldn't have done that.
Paul Popplewell was doing a play on the night of the party in Cannes, so Paul Ryder played at the party instead, and Paul Popplewell flew in after the show.
I arrived at the villa when people were sort of getting ready to go to bed or something. I had a couple of days in Cannes, and I really ought not to have gone because I was supposed to start filming something else on the Monday. Ironically, we were starting a film, a BBC film called Rehab in London.
Oh. Rowetta was there as well. She was singing with them.
Yeah, yeah. But it took us an hour to get in the place. He wasn't letting us in. Another Spinal Tap moment. Couldn't get in my own party.
But it was a fun time, wasn't it? It was a really fun time. And that movie was directed by Michael Winterbottom, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing director.
Also, they discovered Michael Winterbottom was so blown away by his acting. He just said he really plays sinister well to play this secure, what are you going to call them, but the gangsters, really, who ran the door. And he was really impressed with his acting.
I think that was really good for Paul as well to do some acting. And...
Absolutely. And because Michael Winterbottom really, he said he's just a natural. He was really impressed.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah. And Paul Popplewell, who played you,
yes,
actually ended up staying with us when they were filming and became really good friends with him.
We went to his wedding.
Yeah.
I was very relieved during the movie that when he was on the tour bus naked, that when he turned round, he had a big cock.
I know.
I was so pleased. It was like, yeah, go on.
I can't say this without blushing.
You can.
I regret doing it, is the truth.
Why?
Doing a full frontal.
Why?
Well, come on, it wasn't necessary. And I've got kids now. I'd love to show my kids that film, but how do you show your kids a film that you get your bits out in?
You didn't do anything bad with it, though, did you? You didn't use it as a lethal weapon.
No, but Roetta used a whip as a lethal weapon and smacked my arse. In the same scene.
Your kids would appreciate the art, just tell them the director made you do it.
They're a bit young, yeah. But, yeah, I know Paul was pleased about that. But I'm not going to say that.
Don't put that in. Don't put that in.
Oh, dear. Look at me. Don't put that in.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Okay, so during that point, we bought the house in France, which we talked about last time.
Uh-huh.
And one of my strongest memories of France was you, again, struggling with your heroin addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And we planned to go to Prague because when we'd gone to New York to film the flashbacks video, which was the Big Arm video.
Yeah, yeah.
I went to the place where I used to live when I lived in New York in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And in the place next door to where I used to live, there was this sign in the window and it said, if you're a struggling heroin addict, look into Ibogaine.
Mm.
So we started researching Ibogaine.
What a strange substance that is.
So Ibogaine is something that is found in the root
of the Tabernacus ibogoa plant.
Oh, that's right.
Only found in the southern tip of Cameroon.
That's right.
That's where it grows.
Yeah. And apparently several decades ago, some heroin addicts in New York had all taken Ibogaine, because it's a bit like ayahuasca, I think. Like it's psychoactive, you go on some sort of weird trip.
Yeah.
But the weird thing was that these heroin addicts that took it recreationally,
mm-hmm,
the next couple of weeks found that they had no desire to use heroin again.
And no bad detox. No cold turkey, no anything.
And so a professor from, I believe, Miami was investigating it and was doing research into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it had started, this was like about 20 years ago, it had started to get some sort of recognition. So I did some homework and I found a guy in Prague,
uh-huh,
that performed Ibogaine therapy for heroin addicts.
Mm-hmm.
So we booked flights to Prague.
Why didn't you come?
Because the night before, Chico had gone weird, had had some sort of blood sugar issue and had to go into the hospital in France.
Right.
So we ended up not being able to go with you, so you went on your own to Prague to meet this guy that we'd never met before. Who was going to perform this extremely dangerous therapy, because apparently if you take heroin on top of the Ibogaine, you die. Like, it's as simple as that. And that's why...
It makes the heroin stronger.
Yeah, I think subsequently... Mm-hmm. It's not really been explored any further because of the risks with it. But,
yeah, very risky.
So tell us about that trip to Prague.
Oh, God, it was like... I ended up on this, like, housing estate, communist... from communist Prague. Well, you know, them big, sprawling, like, flats that they have.
Yeah.
I ended up there, thinking I was stuck in communist country. But it obviously wasn't, because it had started to open up to the Western world.
Yeah.
And he gave me this Ibogaine, and I've never took anything like it in my life. It's not like LSD. It's not like anything. But it sent me on a weird trip where I thought I was in communist Russia, and I thought he was trying to kill me. Wow. So I got on the phone to you. And said, "What's going on? I've no idea what this stuff is. It's sending me on a weird one." And you had to calm me down and say everything was okay, just to get on with it.
But I didn't even know that everything was okay. I was stuck in France with the kids. You're in Prague in a high-rise building with some guy that we'd never met. And he was kind of strange, wasn't he, the guy?
Yeah. Nice guy, but a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Especially when you've taken Ibogaine, he kind of got weirder. Yeah. But his heart was in the right place. He was helping addicts. He was helping. Yeah. He helped a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because you can't just take it and be on your own. You got to have somebody watching you.
Yeah. But then 2 weeks later, you had to do it again.
Yeah.
And you did it again in the house in France.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember our friend Jeanette Jackson was there.
Yeah.
Jeanette's a really good friend of ours. She's a biochemist, a nutritional therapist, and she's a radio DJ with her own show on Rossendale Radio 104.7 FM.
So Paul picked me up from the airport, and Paul really was the addict then. I mean, he was not in a good place then. I'd never seen Paul like that, like an addict, like twitchy and, you know, just very different to what I'd seen of him. But one, he was the addict that turned up, and two, was an addict that was going through a detox very soon. So he was highly strung. He was nervous. He was anxious. And we got to the car, and we're just about to get in the car, and he was going to start a cigarette, light a cigarette. And I said, "Paul, please, honestly, I'm not being funny, but I can't get in the car with you smoking. Like, it'll make me feel sick. I can't do it." So he wasn't happy. And so then we had to stop, honestly, every 2 to 3 miles so that Paul could get out of the car and have a cigarette. So a 2.5 hour journey, which should have been, took well over 4.5 hours, because every 2 to 3 miles, Paul got out of the car to have a cigarette. Which was just hilarious on some level, but, like, really frustrating on others.
I remember walking down in the village with her, and you were about to do this, and she said to me, "Angela, it's just another Tuesday afternoon. You just have to think it's just a regular Tuesday afternoon."
Wow, that's good advice.
I've never forgotten that. Yeah, I've never forgotten that. Mm-hmm. It's just another Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah.
My memory of being with Paul at the Chateau on his heroin detox was Paul was in the attic, right at the top of the Chateau, and you and I were downstairs in the lounge in the kitchen at the bottom of the Chateau, like a long, long, long way away from each other. And Paul was in a room going through torture. And I really mean torture. Like, my memory is of hearing Paul crying and screaming and howling, like an animal howling as he came off or he was going through this Ibogaine detox.
See, I have no recollection of that at all. Isn't it weird how we selectively remember things or selectively block things out? I don't remember hearing him howling. All I remember is you and me walking through the village. We went for a walk. We were walking, and I remember the exact spot where I was in the village. And you said to me,
Go on, tell me what you remember what you said.
Because whilst Paul was going through this Ibogaine detox, because it was so, you know, horrifying, the screams and the howls, and time seemed to stand still in the chateau. Like, we lost days, it seemed to me. And it was bleak and it was scary. And so eventually you and I went off to the market and said, we need to get out. And when we got out to the market, there was life, people chatting. It was just another day. And I turned to you and said, Angela, it's just a Tuesday. It's just a Tuesday. Because you and I being in that chateau whilst Paul was going through this detox was like being in a different, really, really different world. So when we realised it was Tuesday, we both kind of came back to the now and went, oh, it's Tuesday. Yeah, it was a strange, yeah, it was surreal, wasn't it? Yeah, absolutely surreal.
And it was very hard to actually grasp that concept, but when I did, it really helped me. It was like, oh, right, yeah, it is. It's just another Tuesday afternoon.
It wasn't, though, because you weren't doing this psychoactive drug that could have killed you in our France house.
It was a good way to look at it, though, yeah. Just another Tuesday afternoon.
So did it work?
Yeah, it works. It's a really good detox. It's over. The height of it only lasts for 45 minutes, but you're still kind of under the influence hours later because it takes it out of you.
Mm-hmm.
But the main bulk of it is a 45-minute kind of trip.
Yeah.
But not like LSD.
I think he deeply wanted to be clean. I think he, it was almost like a different part of him was the addict. That's what I picked up on. Like, he really wanted to be clean. And when, like, for example, when he came out and had that coffee and cigarette early morning, there wasn't an addict there. He just wasn't an addict. He was just a bloke with a lovely house in France, having a cup of coffee first thing in the morning, listening to the birds. So for me, there was a duality there around one person that was an addict and a real desperate addict, and another person I couldn't relate to that just wasn't an addict. And I think for me, if I'm really looking in, I think there was a lot of sorrow about the fact that he was an addict and just didn't want to be one.
And tell me, I remember you saying you met some spirit.
Oh, my ancestors.
Yeah.
That's what he's used as a rite of passage in the Cameroon, right, for the tribes. They use it as a rite of passage to meet their ancestors and come of age. And I did meet my ancestors. Incredible it was.
What, you actually saw them?
Yeah, yeah, this head spinning round like holograms.
Yeah.
While I got my eyes shut.
Yeah, I remember you used to say, oh, I've been to the spirit world.
I've been to the spirit world. Yeah. It took me to the spirit world.
Was it good?
It was great.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah, it sorted a lot of stuff out.
A few years later, we contacted him again and he said he'd stopped doing it because one of his clients had died.
Yeah.
But I think, again, it was because they'd snuck some heroin in there.
I think they did, yeah.
However, it's still... So it scared him enough to...
Yeah, he stopped doing it. He helps a lot of people, but, yeah, he doesn't do it anymore.
We're simply sharing Paul's experience with Ibogaine. We're not trying to convince anybody to try it. If you do want to try it, please make sure that you go to a place where it is legal and you do have proper medical supervision.
It was used in the 1800s as a tincture in France.
Right.
And then they banned it in later on.
Right.
But it was used as a kind of a tincture.
Therapeutic tincture.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you had a little bit of clean time at that point.
Yeah.
But it didn't last, did it?
Didn't last, no.
And it didn't last probably because you didn't, you know, you, again, like with any detox, you have to follow through with working out where the issue came from in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. I had no backup system.
Yeah.
I was just left on my own, raw.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then you started getting implants. Remember the implants?
Oh, my God, yeah. I think I held the record at that clinic for the most implants.
Right, talk about what those implants were. Naltrexone.
Naltrexone implants. I had them in my arms, my stomach. I think I did about a year on them, didn't I?
Yeah, so talk about what the mechanism of action.
Well, the opiate blocker, the naltrexone.
Yeah.
And you have a little operation where they insert a naltrexone capsule into your arm or into your stomach.
Yeah.
And if you take opiates, you just don't feel them. They just do not work.
And you tested it out, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I tested it. Damn right I did. And it didn't work. They did what they were supposed to do.
But again, once more, it didn't fix you because you weren't fixing yourself.
No, exactly, yeah. That's why I say following up with something like one-on-one therapy or group therapy is very important.
And did you get to the root of what was driving your addiction during all this therapy? Did you figure out what it was?
Oh, there was a few things.
Yeah.
Childhood stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And you really think that that was the trigger for everything?
Yeah. Yeah,
do you not think that it was about having too much too soon and fame and being drugs all over the bands? Was that not, did that not play a part?
That played a part, yeah. When you're young as well, when I was in my 20s, you know, you just think you're invincible and you can do all that stuff and it's going to last forever.
Yeah.
But you can't live in Shangri-La forever.
No. One of the other places that you went to was Eric Clapton's clinic in Antigua.
Oh, yeah, I had two stints in there. Yeah, beautiful place.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful. Great food as well. But the second time I went, I did 30 days. Once again, no support afterwards. And I got to the airport when I was leaving after 30 days and jumped in a taxi and said, get me some crack cocaine.
You never told me that.
I know.
I know that you came home and used the day after.
Yeah, that's because I used the day before in Antigua. So before they even got on the plane, I'd used in Antigua.
How did you feel when you did that?
Oh, stupid. I just feel ridiculous.
Was it worth it when you did, was it a good hit?
No, because the guilt and shame came.
Yeah.
The guilt and
shame.
Did
you tell anybody else when you got back that that's what you'd done?
No.
No,
and I only told you yesterday.
I know.
Kept that one secret.
You did. I'm sure you got plenty more secrets as well.
Not really, no.
That you do.
No. I think you know my life.
Jeanette had a hard time relating to the addict side of Paul.
I could never relate to this intense desire and need and want to have drugs. I just could never relate to it. So I related to Paul, the Paul that wasn't the addict, as opposed to Paul that was the addict. And that made me feel so sad because I genuinely, you know, I'm quite instinctive and I'm quite psychic in a way, and I could see the real vulnerability that was Paul at his core, his soul, and that part of Paul wasn't an addict, in my opinion.
Something happened when you were in Antigua. You met somebody. We won't reveal who he said he was, but tell us that story.
Oh, my God, yeah, this guy. He was... I suppose this is a bit like going in rehab and saying, yeah, I met Elvis. Elvis was in rehab. But it's as ridiculous as that. Right,
tell us the story. So he was one of the other patients in the...
He was one of the other patients, and I was in his group, and it was like, this guy's not telling the truth about something. And I said to him, just me and him around the smoking pit...
Describe him, what did he look like?
Oh, he was 6 foot, blonde hair, in his mid-60s, lots of scars on his knees.
Mm.
And I've been in a few group therapies with him in the rehab. And we was outside having a smoke and just meeting him there. And I said to him, you're hiding something. There's something you're not telling us. And he smiled at me and said, I'm a race car driver from the 70s. And I'm supposed to be dead. And it was like, no way.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he faked his own death.
Wow.
And he was a Formula One race car driver from the 70s, and I knew the name, and I looked at him, and he showed me his scars on his knees, because that's what happened in his crash, where he's supposed to have died in this car crash. And I met him. And I believe him.
Yeah, I mean, could it have just been a kind of an alcoholic guy who was deluded, who was...
Could very well be, yeah. But I believed him.
Yeah, I met him too.
Yeah.
I met him too, and I believe him
very
too.
Very believable.
Yeah.
But that goes... The story goes quite deep, but I'm not going to go into it.
In what sense?
Because I might get him in trouble.
I should investigate that further, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I might get in touch with him, see if he's still going.
Yeah. Well, we know where he lives, don't we?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
OK, so... Big Arm.
Mm-hmm.
You did quite a lot of fun promotions for that the two Big Arm singles that got released. One of them involved being on the Frank Sidebottom show with a special 70s iconic guest.
David Soul. I was on a TV show called The Frank Sidebottom Show, like you said. And the other guest was David Soul.
Wow.
And we played a cover version of a fall song. Hit the North. Was it Hit the North?
I don't know.
Can't remember. But David Soul was in my band for 3 minutes while we did this cover version.
And Phil Smethurst went with him to capture everything on camera.
Around 2 weeks later, he needed to come back for the Frank Sidebottom show. And then, yeah, he was kind of straight in, again, unfazed. And then, did he know Frank from... I presume he did. Do you know, I presume that he would have...
Yeah, I think he'd met him, yeah, for sure. But I don't think he knew that David Soul was going to be there as well.
A big hero of his, I think, by all accounts. Yeah, but yeah, he was again kind of unfazed because he was. It would have been the first time, well, one of the first times I imagine that he would have performed on his own, I presume, because he didn't have a band with him.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, yeah, there was a different show he did on Channel M with the whole band. Yeah, you're right. He was just singing to a backing track, wasn't he?
Certainly, Frank was bopping in the back. But yeah, he was kind of unfazed, and for a man that had played bass for so many years to not have your bass with you, he was dancing. He was having a good old dance from what I can remember. He was again in. Having a laugh, got in, did his performance, did his interview, and off he popped. Then we followed him to go on a short film. Yeah, he was just, again, kind of unfazed. He just took everything in his stride, went in, did his gangster bit, did his fake punch. I'd love to have seen how it looked in post. But yeah, he did his fake punch, and then, again, just kind of got his job done and off he popped back to... I think he was heading straight back to France.
And as Rosemary Barrett recalls, Paul was already a big fan of Frank.
When we went to France, John took a load of Frank Sidebottom animated videos for the kids to watch. And when we got there, there was no telly or anything like that. So Paul was really into Frank Sidebottom. And so he just stayed up the whole night watching Frank Sidebottom animated videos the whole night. I remember that because the kids were like, "Ooh, yeah." I don't know if you remember that, but that was one thing that it was. He just loved it. He was chuckling away, you know, watching Frank on his on doing his little. That was probably the Worldwide Shed show. That was what it was. So I just remember that. Paul was there watching them like on a loop.
It's great as the credits are rolling, you can hear David Soul saying, "This is the most stupidest thing I've ever done." But it was great to meet David Soul.
Other weird celebrity encounters you had. Do you remember you met Petula Clark? We took the kids to Disneyland in Orlando, and Petula Clark happened to be singing there.
She was performing that night in Disneyland.
And then you met her afterwards.
Yeah, told her I was a fan.
Yeah, and it was like, oh, we should collaborate. Can you imagine you and Petula Clark? That would have been cool.
That would have been good. Yeah, we met Petula.
Which other celebrities have you met that have kind of had an impact on you? You must have rubbed shoulders with a lot of people.
Oh, I've met a lot of celebrities, but the only one I was really starstruck with was Bowie.
Yeah.
I was like, I couldn't even speak to him. Yeah. I just stared at him.
Yeah.
Thinking, God, that's David Bowie stood next to me.
Yeah.
Proper starstruck.
Yeah. Did you have did you meet anybody else that you did actually manage to speak to?
Not really. I was pretty shy.
Yeah.
I was pretty, didn't want to mind the people.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've met a lot of celebrities over the years.
Didn't you kiss Lisa Stansfield on a tour bus once?
No. That was the girl out of Delight.
Oh, Lady okay. Miss Keir.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was the Lisa Stansfield story?
Oh, she was at the same party in Brazil. We went to Prince's party.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
did you meet Prince?
No, we got told as we was walking in, don't look at Prince, don't talk to Prince, don't approach Prince. Oh. If he gets on the dance floor, move away from Prince.
Oh.
So we got our instructions.
From who?
From his security. So we all walked in and went, there's Prince! There's fucking Prince over there! Yo, Prince!
What did he do?
Just sat there. He just sat there. You can't tell a load of Manx not to do that. He's obviously going to do it.
Yeah, with knobs on.
Mm-hmm.
I was live on air and I was presenting a 3-hour radio show. And I thought I never ever on all the radio shows ever look at the news. I never do it because you prep your show and you know what you're going to talk about. But because this was a 3-hour show, I just thought I'll just have a quick, I was going on the news to find something I wanted to talk about. And I went on the news and it came up, Paul Ryder is dead. And honestly, I was in such shock. I was just in utter shock and I was live on air. I cancelled some links and just made the show run for a little while. And then I spoke to my producer and said, I'm in shock because my friend Paul Ryder has passed away. I've just seen it and I'm live on air. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, well, how do you feel? Do you feel okay to announce it if he's your friend? I feel emotional now. Oh, I feel emotional. And he said, you know, if he's your friend and you loved him, announce it on air. So I did. And I said, I'm going to let you know that a dear friend of mine I've just found out has passed away. It's Paul Ryder and from the Happy Mondays. And I'm really in shock. So, and I said what a beautiful man he was and what a lovely friend. And I played one of the songs. Yeah. And then I went into the second studio and I recorded a few links and then I left and I couldn't stay on air. And honestly, really emotional. I can remember it as if it was yesterday.
Coming up on the next episode.
You've got to slowly come off whatever your drug of choice is. You know, mine was, I was known as a dustbin because... I'd take anything and large amounts of it. So I was detoxing off all kinds of different things that had taken over the years.
Mortified. Not so much about Paul. Mortified. The boys. That was it. Oh, we were heartbroken. How could you do that? Take Sonny and Chico away from us. And the day you moved to LA was the day Sean came to live round here.
So we flew to Denver, we arrived, checked in the hotel, and you went to do your DJ set in Denver. And then at about 2 o'clock in the morning, I heard this kerfuffle outside the room and struggling to open the door, and you literally fell into the hotel room absolutely drunk as a skunk.
While Angela and Paul were there, yeah, he were great. And then as soon as Angela and Paul left, they were like, can we have a drink? No. Hey? Like, why are you turned into a massive arsehole?
Wow, I just couldn't even speak to him. It was like... just couldn't get any words out. It was like George Harrison. I'm sat next to George Harrison, who's feeding me egg and salmon sandwiches.
We're playing out with the song Paul and Pete Smith did with Rowetta around the time of the 24-hour Party People film. You'll probably recognise some parts from it. Listen very carefully. It's called Party People. please join our Patrons Club by going to patreon.com/thePaulRyderTapes and check out our shop by going to the website www.paulryder.tv, which also has links to the socials. Come and join in the conversation. We will be back same time, same place next week. Thank you so much for being here. We really, really appreciate you. Please continue to spread the word about this project. Thank you to the guests, and big thanks, as always, goes to the star of the show, the one and the only, the late, great Paul Anthony Ryder. Party people, party sounds. Everybody's gotta get up to get down. Party people, party town. Everybody's gotta get up to get down. Glistening Productions.
Put it in.
No,
that would be really funny.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.